G'day everyone, this is B. Jermaine, aka The Terrible Australian, and welcome to the 14th and final installment of my 2019 Melbourne International Film Festival audio reviews. We're finally here. This is the very last one for the year, and for this one I will be reviewing the films The Nightingale, Little Monsters, and Children of the Sea. And not only that, I will also be unveiling my top 10 films from MIFF 2019. So we definitely have a lot to talk about for this final installment, so let's get right to it. But before I go into my reviews of the films that we're going to be talking about for this one, I should state right off the bat that my colleague and podcast co-host, Super Marcy, has written full-length written reviews of all three of the films that I'm going to be discussing in this final audio review special, which of course, once again, are The Nightingale, Little Monsters, and Children of the Sea. So I'll do my best to kind of share my thoughts on the films, but if you want to know what Marcy thought on all three of these films, go check out her reviews because they are fantastic, and they'll probably do a much better job at sort of diving into these films than I probably will for this final audio review. So, but we shall see. So definitely give those a check out after you listen to this installment. So let's get right to it. And of course, the very first film I'm going to be talking about for this one, of course, is the Babadook director Jennifer Kent's latest film, The Nightingale. And the plot summary for this film, which I am reading once again from the MIFF program guide, is as follows. After being deported to Van Diemen's Land for thievery, Irish convict Claire, Aisling Francosi, finds herself living a nightmare under the rule of a sadistic lieutenant, Sam Claflin. Sometimes he forces Claire to sing for his troops, who dub her their little nightingale. More often, he forces himself on her, and there's little she or her husband can do to stop him, until Claire reaches a breaking point and sets her mind to revenge, with a little help from a local Aboriginal tracker, Billy. Bekali Ganamba. Now, it would be a massive understatement to say that The Nightingale is without a doubt one of the most talked about and controversial films of 2019. Ever since the film made its world premiere at the Venice Film Festival last year, it has had nothing but such a divisive reaction from both audiences and critics. People either love this film or some people absolutely hate it. And when you kind of read up for the reasons why, it's pretty clear to see and understand why that is. Because ever since after the film screened at the Venice Film Festival and won two awards, during a Q&A, a male film critic screamed misogynistic things to Jennifer Kent, which became very well known in the news and picked up quite a few headlines. And then, of course, when the film sort of played at other film festivals afterwards, like the Adelaide Film Festival, the Sundance Film Festival, and most infamously the Sydney Film Festival, audiences have let them know how they felt about this film. A lot of people have found this such a powerful and disturbing experience, but for some people, it was a film that's was just way too much to them, that they literally walked out of the film, or while they were doing that, screaming obscenities at both the film and director Jennifer Kent. Like, and so that was on the back of my mind in the lead up to watching the film at MIFF this year, because that was kind of the thing that most people were talking about. And not only just how this film contains so much disturbing elements, but it's also one that it's just people just like are pretty much right down the middle on. People either love it or they hate it. So I knew kind of what to expect. Like I kind of was kind of, when I hear sort of a film like that with that, that's very disturbing and is very confronting, a part of me is slightly worried about that, because not to say that I haven't seen tons of films in my life that are just no different from The Nightingale in regards to having disturbing, confronting content. But I guess I was more worried about how the audience was going to react to this film. But that being said, I was still very much looking forward to it. Ever since I personally heard nothing but good things from people who had seen it, and also some negative stuff as well. So I was very curious to see how I would fall on this film. Would I like it? Would I hate it? I was just intrigued because of that. And for me, when a film just gets such a divisive reaction from audiences, to me, that's what makes it a much more interesting film. So I definitely knew, regardless how I felt either way, I was going to have a lot to say about it. Now, having seen the film, I gotta say, I absolutely loved it. It is pretty much, I am definitely on the pro camp when it comes to The Nightingale. I thought The Babadook was a fantastic debut film for Jennifer Kent. And that was a film that, when I saw it the first time, I really liked it a lot. But the more times I watched it, I loved it more and more. And eventually so much, though, that when my top 10 of 2014 came out that year, The Babadook was more of an honorable mention that year. But in the years since, and the more viewings I've seen of The Babadook, I have now actually put it up to my number 2 spot of my top 10 films of 2014. So that was a film that really I appreciated and loved more and more the more times I saw it. And so, but that being said, it also was a great showcase for a strong filmmaker with a great voice like Jennifer Kent, who definitely is one of the most exciting new filmmakers working today. And with The Nightingale, she like some people are kind of worried, like when they make their sophomore effort, that it's not going to be able to live up to the promise of their debut. But for me, The Nightingale just achieved that. This was a fantastic film that is very much exactly like the word of mouth describes it. It is a very powerful film. It is disturbing. It's confronting. And it is very hard to watch at times. But for me personally, and I can understand people being too repelled and distressed by that, but for me personally, given the type of story that it is, and this is a film that sort of explores the dark part of Australia's colonial past and sort of the horrible things that happened during that time to both our Indigenous Australians, to women, and also to Irish immigrants and convicts. Like, this film needed to approach that stuff in a very honest and authentic way. And like, I can definitely see some people kind of saying that the film did it way too much at times in exploring the violence and the repeated sexual assaults and rape and other disturbing aspects. But for me, it's important that a film like this kind of show that. And so that because we sort of growing up, like it, when we learn about our colonial past in history books and in class and all that, we sort of hear about it, but we don't really sort of take it in as much, or at least what it was like living at that time. And for a film like The Nightingale, and what I appreciate about it is that when it tackles those darker elements of Australia's history, it just goes full on into it and doesn't sugarcoat it. And basically, this film is saying, this is what happened at that time. You can hate it, you can be disturbed and distressed by it, but this is the type of stuff that happened, and we need to acknowledge it. Acknowledge the racism, the bigotry, the discrimination, the misogyny, and all that stuff is showcased in this film. And for me, that this film, I don't feel like this is a film that revels in it. Like, this is it is a very tough film to watch, but it's not a miserable film. Like, it's not a film where you just feel like you almost want to kill yourself after when you watch it. But in a lot of ways, I think Jennifer Kent using sort of a simple revenge story at the center of it was a great idea, because you can tackle this very simple story, but building around all the themes and all the history that she wanted to explore within this story. And for me, that's what really elevated this film to something truly great and powerful. And for me, like, I feel like I said before, when we've heard about this part of our history, we don't really fully grasp it as a whole. But when you kind of watch it, how it's played out in this film, for us as an audience, that's when we finally get it, like what that period of history was like. And even though, yet a lot of really horrible stuff happens in this film, but Jennifer Kent has said in interviews that if she actually went 100% accurate to everything that happened at the time, this film would be much, much worse. And at least in terms of how it showcases the violence, the misogyny, and the sexual assault and everything. So, like, it is a very tough film. And, like, for me, the toughest part was definitely the first 20, 25 minutes. And after I got past that hurdle, because that was kind of the part of the film I was dreading the most, given what I've heard about it, after when that sort of hurdle hit, I knew what to expect from the rest of the film, and I was able to sort of really enjoy it. I mean, enjoy is probably not the best word I could use, but I'd be more compelled by it. But the funny thing is about this film, like, it's also quite funny. And I'm not saying that this is a film where there's constant humor around, like, throughout it or anything, but there are moments of levity through this film. And for me, that was kind of important, because you need that for a film as dark as this. And the fact that it's in there really sort of helped liven the mood, but also kind of shows how believable the whole situation is, because, you know, in life, there's tragedy, there's horror, but there's also humor in it as well. And also, just on a filmmaking level, Jennifer Kent just outdoes everything here that she did in The Babadook. And The Babadook was an impressive film on a filmmaking level, but this is just goes even further. It's beautifully shot. Like, the film is done in a letterbox ratio, which compared to The Babadook, it was shot in the 2:35 frame. And I've heard some people kind of criticize that visual look, but for me, it gave the film a much more intimate quality and also made it much more claustrophobic, especially since a lot of the film is basically a chase film through the Tasmanian wilderness, and it just adds that sort of claustrophobic feel to the whole thing. Like, it's brilliantly well written. Like, just when you know where this film is going to go, it takes a bit of a turn as well. And also, it's just the score, the cinematography, everything is just so great about this film. But at the end of the day, for me, what also made this film really work, of course, are the performances, particularly the film's two leads, Ashley Francozzi and newcomer Bekali Ganamba. If I butcher both these actors' names, please forgive me. These two, like, I know Ashleen played Lyanna Stark in flashbacks in a season of Game of Thrones, so that's the only thing I kind of recognize her from. But newcomer Ganamba, like, these two, this film is put on their shoulders, and they're both fantastic. Their performances are truly great, and their chemistry with each other is just pitch perfect. And I really like that there's kind of, even though they're helping each other out, there's kind of a hostility between the two of them, which I thought was really interesting. And as the film goes on, they sort of start to kind of, their friendship begins to develop, and they realize that they both want the same things, and they're just so fantastic. And but also they're matched with Sam Claflin, who is an actor who I've always liked, and, you know, from the Hunger Games films and also Me Before You, I always liked him because he always has this kind of likable charm about him, and also very British quality to him. And without a doubt, as the film's villain, he is just phenomenal. He goes at this performance with 110%, and he plays his character as truly evil. And for me, this is without a doubt, this would have been a very challenging role for him, especially, and also a cast against type kind of role as well. And he just nails it. He is such a hateable villain. But he's also a very interesting one as well, which I feel like he could have easily just been completely one note, but Kent just adds little interesting layers to him that make him really interesting as a villain. And yeah, it's just a fantastic film. I could talk endlessly about this film, but I don't want to go on forever about this in this final audio review. So all I'm going to say is that The Nightingale is a absolutely brilliant film. It won't be for everyone, and it is very disturbing and confronting. So if you do go out and see this film, definitely brace yourself for that, because this is a film that's not going to take you by the hand. This is going to throw you into this situation and confront you with some really dark and violent stuff. But if you do, but I'd say go along with it, and it will be an absolutely powerful experience, like it was for me. And yeah, it's definitely just a brilliant film, so check it out. So if I had to give The Nightingale a rating, I give it 5 out of 5. It was just an absolutely brilliant film. Now, moving right along to the second film, which of course is the Australian zombie horror comedy Little Monsters. And the plot summary for this one is as follows. Lupita Nyong'o is Miss Caroline, who's off on a day trip to Pleasant Valley with her class of overly excitable 5-year-olds. Accompanying them is slacker musician Dave, Alexander England, whose nephew Felix is one of Miss Caroline's charges, although his reasons for tagging along are less than wholesome. But the enamorous intentions of immature uncles are the least of Miss Caroline's problems when a beloved children's entertainer, Josh Gad, proves to be a vile, foul-mouthed drunk, and the US military base next door accidentally unleashes a horde of the undead. Now, it's kind of interesting for me, like, watching this, like, The Nightingale and Little Monsters, because both films were produced by the same producers, and with Nightingale, that is such a full-on, powerful, dramatic, and dark Australian film that looks at a very dark period of Australia's colonial history. While on the other end of the spectrum, you have Little Zombies, which is a full-on horror comedy that tackles the zombie genre. And they could both be miles apart. And for me, that kind of shows the versatility behind the producers and filmmakers of both these films. And with Little Monsters... I gotta say, this was definitely one of my most anticipated for the film festival, for a lot of reasons, because the film has got a great cast. I mean, I love Oscar-winning actress Lupita Nyong'o. For me, she's just, no matter what film she is, whether she's on screen or behind the scenes doing a voice, she is always great and brings her A game. And this year in particular has been great for her because she, of course, had her amazing performance in the film Us, which of course was another horror film, and also Josh Gad, who some people either like or dislike, but I personally like him myself, and also Alexander England, who's this really funny Australian actor who's kind of going on the up and up over the last few years. But another reason why I was very much looking forward to this film, other than being a zombie film, of course, which, you know, zombie films are my jam, is, of course, the film's writer-director, Abe Forsyth, who I've been following for at least 15 years or so, because he started off his career as being an actor who starred in films and TV, particularly the Australian TV show Always Greener, which I used to watch a lot. And then, of course, he moved into filmmaking. He made the 2003 spoof film Ned, which, of course, was a comedy about the life of Ned Kelly, which some people, of course, sort of been that film has been sort of mixed with a lot of people, but I personally really enjoyed that movie. And of course, after that, he made a whole bunch of, still continued the act, but also made a whole bunch of shorts throughout that time. And he didn't make his next feature film until 2016, when he made the dark comedy Down Under, which I absolutely loved and was one of my personal favorite films of 2016. It didn't make my top 10, but it was just outside of it. It was that great of a follow-up. So now, 3 years later, he's back with his third film, which is this one, Little Monsters. And I gotta say, I enjoyed this one as well. I don't think this film is quite on the level as Down Under, but it kind of makes sense because Down Under, even though it was a dark comedy, it dealt with a very sort of, like The Nightingale, a very dark period of Australia, but this time being back in the mid-noughties when we had the Cannella riots. But with Little Monsters, though, this is a film that pretty much he has set out to make a really fun and entertaining horror comedy involving zombies. And I have to say, I thought he succeeded at that. It's not the most original of its type, and I think that's probably why, even though I really like this film a lot, when my final rating for it comes a bit later on after this review, the reason why it's not as high for me on the rating scale is because it's not the most original zombie film we've ever seen. Like, it does have kind of the cliches and that. And if anything, the zombie aspect of the film isn't quite as developed as the other stuff around it. And for me, what made this film work was, of course, the characters. And I particularly like the setting, having this film set at a petting zoo and having sort of the main characters be, you know, a slacker musician, a very awesome kindergarten teacher, and of course, the group of 5-year-olds that they have to protect from the zombies. And of course, the kind of the human bad guy of the story, who is like this children's entertainer played by Josh Gad. So for me, that's kind of what really made the film work overall, was the characters and their interactions with each other. And of course, the script is just also really funny too. This is a film that kind of has a different mixture of humor throughout. But I will say though, if you're a person who doesn't like lowbrow comedy, this film might not be for you, because there is quite a number of lowbrow jokes throughout this whole film. But there are some pretty fun and clever ones as well. But for me, a lot of the humor worked for me. And I do, as much as I do like high quality humor as much as the next person, I do like a bit of lowbrow humor every now and again. And there was quite a few moments throughout this film that did make me laugh in that regard. And yeah, I liked the characters. I thought everyone did such a great job with their performances. Alexander England, he's a character who I could definitely see some people kind of being off a bit at first, because at first he is a kind of a little obnoxious, but as the film goes along and he goes through his arc, he becomes a much more likable character. And also Josh Gad gets to kind of flex his repertoire as an actor by tackling this really vile and very like devious kind of children's entertainer. But for me, without a doubt, the best performance in the film, of course, is Lupita Nyong'o as Miss Caroline. Like I said, I love Lupita Nyong'o. And for me, this film, along with Us, kind of shows how much of a great range she has as an actress. With, you know, not just Us, but also like 12 Years a Slave. Like, she's shown her sort of how much of a great dramatic actress she is, and she just dives into these roles and fully commits to them and just inhabits these characters. And with Miss Caroline, you get to see another side of her as being this really lovely, charming, very funny kindergarten teacher who's a complete badass as well and will do anything to protect her kids. And and she's also very funny as well, which is great, because you get to see that side of her. And she's just so great. And also the kids, like, some people can kind of be sort of mixed on kids in films, particularly very young ones. But I thought all the kids in this film just were great, and they just had so many lovely moments. And also the young actor who plays the character of Dave's nephew, Felix, who I can't think of the young kid's name at the moment, so please forgive me. He pretty much steals every scene in the whole film. And he's a very likable kid. He's not obnoxious. He actually acts like a kid, especially at that age. And there are so many really funny moments with him as well, which I won't spoil, but I just really enjoyed him as a character. And of course, the zombie stuff is also pretty cool as well. For me, I guess that's kind of like the undeveloped aspect, because it is very, you know, we've seen this type of thing before, you know, zombies break out of a military base and they take over and stuff like that. So those kind of cliches are all there in this film. And for me, that's probably why the film was just more pretty good rather than great for me, because it didn't really sort of do anything too new in terms of the zombie stuff. But when it came to sort of the non-zombie aspect of the film, like the characters, the humor, that's when it worked a lot better. And overall, I really enjoyed Little Monsters. It is a fun horror comedy with so many wonderful performances. And of course, if you're a big zombie fan like I am, it still provides some really fun zombie entertainment as well. And if you're a huge Lupita Nyong'o fan, definitely check this film out, because she is great in it. So if I had to give Little Monsters a rating, I give it a solid 3.5 out of 5. I really enjoyed it a lot. And I could definitely see myself even enjoying it even more on repeated viewings. Now, moving right along to the very final film that I'll be talking about from MIFF 2019 this year, which of course is the Japanese anime Children of the Sea. And the plot summary for this film is as follows. Teenager Ruka has always been fascinated by the sea. Both parents are oceanographers, and her dad works at the local aquarium where, when Ruka was younger, she saw a glowing ghost calling to her from the water. After meeting Yumi and Sora, two boys raised by dugongs, she's drawn back to the ocean's vivid depths with her new friends, just as the world's marine life begins to mysteriously disappear. Now, like a couple of films that I saw in MIFF this year, Children of the Sea was actually one that was a very last-minute addition to my viewing list. I wasn't originally planning on seeing this film, but a bunch of friends of mine who I knew were planning on seeing it, and they wanted to know if I was interested in seeing it as well. So I sort of read up a little bit on it, and I thought, it sounds interesting. So I decided to give it a shot. And for me personally, when I go to MIFF every year, I always make the effort to at least see one or more animated films at the festival. And for me personally, a lot of the animated films that I'd seen at MIFF over the last couple of years always ended up being some of my favorites at the film festival. So with this one though, I wasn't sure what to expect. Like I knew, like the plot was interesting, but I kind of had a feeling there had to be something more to it than that. And I, in my mind, I had a bit of an idea what the film was going to be like, but now having seen it, this film was definitely not what I expected. I will say this though, for the first two halves though, the film was kind of what I expected. I sort of found it to be this like really charming and entertaining sort of coming of age film that's basically about the friendship between this young, lonely girl and these two boys who just happened to live in the sea and were raised by dugongs. And which for me, I like, one of the things I do like about Japanese anime films is that they can have the most bizarre of premises, but how they're sort of approached though, the filmmakers bring a lot of humanity to those stories that no matter how ridiculous everything happens on screen, you just instantly believe it, and you just become so emotionally involved with it. And I definitely was from the very beginning of this film, and for the first two halves, I just found it really fun and engaging. And at the same time, though, I kind of kept thinking, like, where is the story going to go? Because there were little plot threads that the film was setting up, and I kept thinking, like, where is this story going to go? And I kind of had in the back of my mind where I thought the film was going to go, but when the film gets to the third act, it went into places I did not expect at all. And I'm not going to go into too much spoiler territory, but what I will say about this last half is that it is completely and utterly insane. But that being said though, like this entire third act I could definitely see making or breaking people, because some of the friends who I went and saw the film with, they enjoyed the film until the ending, because, and then once that third act hit, they pretty much, it just lost them after that. But for me personally, I was more intrigued by anything else. Like, I honestly, to even like now, a few weeks after the film festival being over, like looking back on the film, like, I honestly have no idea what the hell happened in that third act, but I was still intrigued nonetheless and found it quite a hypnotic experience as well. And I will say this though, that animation in the third act is definitely without a doubt what some of the most breathtaking that I have ever seen in a film. And it is an absolutely visually stunning experience. And like, I've seen a lot of great animation, and over the last few years, the world of animation has definitely gotten better and better in terms of how animation is presented in films. For example, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, which has probably, without a doubt, some of the most original and unique animation I've seen in a film. And then you got this entire third act of Children of the Sea, which just pushes the medium even further to places I didn't honestly expect it would go to. And for me, like, as bewildered I was by this entire third act, I was just in awe of the visual splendor that was happening on screen. And I guess the only way that I could be able to describe this entire third act, myself and my colleague and podcast co-host, Super Marcy, because when we were talking about the film afterwards, we pretty much described as this third act is almost like the film basically is like you think as a coming of age family film, but then the third act basically turns into, and minor spoilers for the films I'm about to mention, The Tree of Life and 2001 A Space Odyssey. So those comparisons to those two films definitely have you intrigued? Believe me, you ain't seen nothing yet. And it's funny though, whenever people ask me how I felt about the film, I use those two comparisons that Marcy and I came up with. And funnily enough, it just makes them even more intrigued to check out the film. So that alone, like, it definitely, as a film on its own, it definitely isn't perfect. Like I said, I think the first two halves, the first two acts are really well done. The voice acting is really good. The animation is just beautiful. All the scenes with the underwater sea life is just beautiful. And like I said, once it gets to that third act, I honestly don't know what the hell is going on in this third act, but it's such a visually stunning experience that I just went along with it. And I'm still thinking about what the film overall is trying to say on a thematic level, or what kind of point it's trying to say. But what I do like about the film is that even now, like a few weeks out after seeing it, I'm still talking about it and thinking about it. So it's definitely not a perfect film, and it definitely won't be for everyone. Like I said, I expected it to be one thing and then it turned out to be a completely different thing. But I think if you just go along with it, hopefully you'll probably get just as much out of it as I did. And I think it's an interesting enough film that I would say it's worth checking out for sure. And if you're a big fan of animation, definitely check this one out, because the animation in this is just a sight to behold. So overall, if I had to give Children of the Sea a rating, I give it a solid 3.5 out of 5. So yeah, that's it. That's all of them done. That was the very last film that I've reviewed from MIFF 2019. Overall, this year I saw 55 films. I originally was planning on seeing 57 or 58, but due to circumstances, I wasn't able to see the two free films that I originally planned. But that, nonetheless, I saw 55 in the end, and I gotta say, I really enjoyed myself this year. But compared to sort of other previous years of the film festival, I thought this year overall, in terms of the films that I saw, as much as I did quite enjoy a lot of them, I don't know, something about this year, this to me, it wasn't a great year at MIFF. It was just merely a good one, which is kind of interesting because, like, the last 2 years, like 2016, I mean, last 3 years, 2016, 2017, and 2018, definitely without a doubt some of the best years that I've had at MIFF. And that because there were so much great films that came out of those festivals and those respective years, particularly last year, because last year gave me First Reformed and Mandy, and those two films end up being in my top five of the films of that year. But this year, and I also gave, like, you know, five films 5 stars and about 12 or, and I think about 7 or 8 films about 4.5 as well, and multiple 4s and stuff and all that. But this year though, like, I wasn't hugely impressed with the overall, you know, quality of the film festival this year. Not to say that all the films were bad or anything. There was quite a number of films I really liked, but there wasn't sort of there, but there was very few that I really loved. And so, I mean, like I said, compared to last year, which I thought was an amazing year, this one was only just a pretty good one. So, but that being said though, I had a really good time. I saw some really great films that I enjoyed, and I got to hang out and meet fellow film critics that I've been wanting to meet for a while. And also I got to spend, like, check out films with my friends and seeing them all and seeing so many different films. So overall, even though, yeah, the quality of the films this year was kind of good, but the actual experience overall was great. And I honestly cannot wait for next year. I love going to MIFF every year, so bring on MIFF 2020. It's going to be I have a feeling it's going to be a great year. But that being said, though, before I finish up this final audio review, a lot of you are probably wondering, what were some of my favorite films at MIFF this year? So here they are. Here are my top 10 films from MIFF 2019. I'm not going to go too in-depth with these since I already did audio reviews for all these films. So I'll just go through a lot of them very briefly. Number 10 was the Australian family film H for Happiness, which for me was one of the most entertaining and charming films that I saw at MIFF this year, and one that I could definitely see being a huge hit when it comes out, if, you know, the distributors play their cards right. So when this film comes out, definitely check it. Take the kids to it. It's one that the whole family can enjoy. Number 9 was the documentary on China's one-child policy, One Child Nation. Definitely a great documentary that I found very powerful, as it sort of delved into a subject that I only just knew little about, and having sort of from a very personal view as well, since one of the film's directors was actually living through all this during that time all this policy was happening, really sort of made it a much more intimate and very impactful film. So yeah, One Child Nation was great. Check it out when it gets released. Number 8 was the film Swallow, which for me was definitely one of the biggest surprises I saw at MIFF this year, and one that I actually literally just ended up choosing at the very, very last minute. And for me, this was one that paid off. This was an absolutely great film that has a very sort of disturbing and bizarre premise at the center of it that could easily have been just used for exploitation. But instead, the filmmakers use it to tell a much more interesting and compelling story, and it has a great performance from Hayley Bennett at the center of it. So again, highly recommended, and check this one out when it gets released. It is really good. Number 7 was Portrait of a Lady on Fire, but like I said in my review of it, I don't think it's quite the masterpiece that everyone has been saying, but it's still a great film that's beautifully crafted, beautifully acted, and it's just a really effective love story. So definitely check that one out as well. Number 6 was the documentary Iron Fists and Kung Fu Kicks. This was definitely one of the most funnest films that I saw at MIFF this year, and just a great documentary that explores both the origins and influences of Kung Fu cinema and how this genre kind of became so huge that it literally kind of changed the landscape of film. And it is such a fun documentary that, I mean, if you're a big fan of docos like Not Quite Hollywood, Machete Maidens Unleashed, and Electric Boogaloo, definitely check this one out. This one was just really awesome. Number five was The Beach Bum, which, like Iron Fist and Kung Fu Kicks, was the one that I had the most fun with this year. This was a film, like, it's basically is a pretty plotless film, but what made this film work is just the great performances from the cast, particularly Matthew McConaughey, who's just firing all cylinders with this performance. It is entertaining, it is hilarious, it's bizarre, and it's just a lot of fun. And for me, it's probably, without a doubt, Harmony Korine's best work to date. Number four was Pedro Almodovar's film Pain and Glory, which of course is a very beautifully crafted and semi-autobiographical film that is just has a great performance from Antonio Banderas at the center of it. And for me, this is definitely up there as one of Almodovar's best works. It's just a great film, and I really hope Antonio Banderas gets an Oscar nod for this, because he deserves it. Number three was the Australian film Hearts and Bones, starring Hugo Weaving. This one really snuck up on me. One of the reasons why I checked it out of the MIFF in the first place was because of the director, Ben Lawrence, who directed one of my top five favorite films from MIFF last year, which is the documentary Ghost Hunter. This film was his narrative directing debut, and he just knocked it out of the park and delivered a very beautiful and powerful film that I'm still thinking about to this day, and I've been singing its praises. And for me, is definitely, like Swallow, one of the big surprises at the film fest. So I didn't expect myself to love this film as much as I did. I thought it was just going to hopefully be pretty good, but for me, this was definitely, without a doubt, one of the best films I saw at MIFF. It is so great, and when it gets released, check this one out as well. Number two was the comedy The Art of Self-Defense. I love a good black comedy when it's done really well, and this film just nails it completely. It's got a Yorgos Lanthimos vibe, which I really dug, and of course the performances from Jesse Eisenberg, Alessandra Nivola, and Imogen Poots are all spot on, and it's just a really fun and original film that is just full of great moments and dialogue, and it's just was an absolute ball to watch. And again, when this comes out, definitely seek it out. But of course, my number one film of MIFF 2019, and one that I could definitely see making into my top 10 films of the year overall, of course, was the film I talked about earlier in this installment, The Nightingale. I've already said already said enough about the film as it is, but I will leave it with that it's just an absolutely powerful and brilliant film that I believe is essential for all Australians to watch. Even though, yes, it is very dark, disturbing, and very confronting, it's one that every Australian needs to see. So, yep, that's it. That's my top 10 films of MIFF 2019. And that's the end for my audio reviews for this year. I want to say thank you for everyone who listened to all my audio, all 14 installments of my MIFF audio reviews this year. I hope you guys all enjoyed them. Apologies if I rambled a lot on any of them. I just had so much to say with a lot of the films. So I promise next year when I do these, I'll try to make them less rambly as possible, but I can't guarantee that. But once again, thanks for everyone for listening to these audio reviews. I hope you guys all enjoyed them. And I'll see you guys at MIFF 2020. So I'll see you guys then. See everyone. Bye.